All right. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to today's program, Understanding the CARES Act, breaking down the $2 trillion stimulus package and what it means for your business. My name is Jerry Bologna. I'm president and CEO of the Jefferson Economic Development Commission. And I'd like to start with a little housekeeping. First of all, to manage today's call, this is going to be a voice call only. We're asking you to submit all questions to info@jedco.org. We'll do our best to get to as many questions as possible. I'll submit those to our panelists. Also, in order to accommodate as many people as possible, we'll be recording this call, and the recording will be placed on the JEDCO website. Today, we'll be joined by four attorneys with Adams and Reese as our panelists, specializing in different areas of practice, but we'll be joined by Chris Kane. Chris is the Global Trade, Transportation, and Logistics Team Leader with Adams and Reese, focusing in economic development and transportation and logistics. He will be discussing funding options as it pertains to the SBA 7A loans and the PPP. We'll also be joined by Greg Ruchel. Greg is a partner and also the labor and employment team leader for Adams and Reese, and he'll be discussing the labor ramifications in the stimulus package. We're also going to be joined by Johnny Damiano. Johnny is the partner in charge at the New Orleans office, and he'll be discussing changes in the tax filing deadlines and those implications. And then finally, we'll be joined by Jeff Brooks. Jeff is the past chairman of the executive committee of Adams and Reese Law Firm. Jeff is based in Washington, D.C., and represents Jefferson Parish in D.C., so he's been uniquely placed to help us with many of our federal priorities in Jefferson Parish. In the last 2 weeks, companies across all industry sectors and all across the United States have had their worlds turned upside down. Businesses have been faced with difficult decisions to lay off employees, scale back operations, adapt to changing environments, and in some cases, shut in their doors. As an organization, JEDCO took immediate action to assist our businesses throughout Jefferson Parish, including all of our municipalities. We began by standing up the JEDCO Business Boost webpage. This was a webpage where nearly 500 of our businesses throughout Jefferson Parish were able to post their modified operating hours and modified operations so that our citizens knew where they can continue to get critical services. We began obtaining surveys throughout the parish. We proactively reached out to over 300 companies and organizations to see where they stood and how we might be able to assist, and had another nearly 200 companies respond to surveys online. We have also acted as matchmaker, and there have been several stories that have been well documented about companies throughout Jefferson Parish donating their services and innovating their products to help during this time. Most importantly, we pushed for federal action that would assist our businesses, mostly in the forms of forgivable loans, understanding that our businesses could not necessarily take on more debt at this time. Those efforts, as well as the efforts of many of our organizations throughout the region, culminated in the passage of the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, or CARES Act. The relief for individuals has been well documented, but there are a number of provisions pertaining to businesses, including the Paycheck Protection Program. I should qualify that the CARES Act was signed into law just on Friday, which means rules and regulations have not been promulgated. That being said, we're going to do our best to discuss the legislation and what it means to our businesses. Before we get to that, I'd like to introduce our parish president, Cynthia Lee Shang, who has been on the news quite a bit informing the public about the parish's actions. And Cynthia, if you have a moment, feel free to share some news with us.
Thank you, Jerry. And I want to thank you for organizing this very important call. I want to assure everyone that we are working, our council offices are working, our mayors, our chiefs of police, behind the scenes collaboration across the board with our medical providers, certainly our business community, law enforcement, school systems, to tackle this common issue to all of us. I want to the extent that you can help, and my concern is that people watch the news and they're getting inundated with this, and we don't really realize just how on the top of the rankings we are. I want to stress, Louisiana is third in the country with regard to positive cases. Louisiana is behind New York and New Jersey. Louisiana is second in the country for deaths. So only the state of New York beats the state of Louisiana, but that is statewide statistics. When you look, drill down to cities, our rates are much, much higher. And New Orleans has the highest death rate in the country. And we in Jefferson Parish also have very high rates. In fact, we're the top 1% of all the counties. We have these rates here in Jefferson Parish. So, you know, I think it's critical that we get out the message that, you know, as testing is delayed and people are waiting for their results, that everyone act like everyone's positive. We really push the social distancing. We are still seeing a little bit too much activity for what those of us who know what's coming down the pike and the mathematical models are coming. We really need to make sure everyone understands the importance of that. Traditionally, those hospitalized, about 15 to 20% of those who get this disease are hospitalized, and about a third of that go on ventilators. But what we're seeing is that in our area, it's a little bit higher than 30% that are going on ventilators because we have just those comorbidities and we just have a lot of those diseases here in our area. I also want to briefly talk about our Alario Center testing. We still hold up that testing site at the Alario Center. Anyone with symptoms, a Louisiana resident over 18, can go get tested at the Alario Center site. The test results are about 3 to 5 days, and we've had some issues with that, and that's you know, not our control, but we're working through those issues. And again, I know you've seen on the news, the convention center is being set up now with the help of the federal government to serve as a level two or a step down type of facility to help reduce the hospital capacity. And so when you're positive and you're on the recovery stage and you don't need that critical care, those patients are going to be moved to the convention center, which is an asset for our whole region one, the whole entire region, Orleans, Jefferson Parish, St. Bernard, and Plaquemines Parish. So I just, in closing, I just want to thank everyone. I know we are being tested, but I am seeing the best in people's efforts to get through this together. Jefferson Parish government is open for business. All of our departments are available online via phone call, and we're taking appointments as necessary. Our buildings are closed to the public, but we in Jefferson Parish are very much open. And to please stay in tune with us at jeffparish.net via our social media pages, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And you can text JP Alert to 888-777 also for the latest information. So thank you so much, Jerry, for allowing me to be part of this.
Thank you, Madam President. Now, without further ado, there's no question that coming out of this bill, the provision that has received the most interest for small business has been the SBA 7A loans, particularly as it relates to them potentially becoming forgivable. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our first panelist, Chris Kane with Adams and Reese.
Thank you, Jerry. A pleasure to join everyone and talk about where we are with the CARES Act, and particularly focusing on the Paycheck Protection Program. Before I do, there's been a lot of questions. Some of you may have already applied for the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program, which was sort of kind of the precursor move that a lot of folks were doing to try to loosen up the ability to get some liquidity. I want you to understand that if you have already applied, been approved for those funds, there is a mechanism to also participate through the PPP by virtue, in essence, the way that it is stated in the Act. It's more or less, it looks like a refinance or folding that into your PPP loan. When we talk about the PPP loan, if you've already gone down that road, this still could apply to you. Now, look, before we get into the specifics in the PPP, part of this act, it's important to understand that right now, while we have the law itself, we're waiting on guidance and the regulations, really the rules of the game, to come down from the Small Business Administration. This program is going to be completed through the 7A loan program. And if you look at the legislation and really what the intent of the legislation was about, it used this particular program, and because it's very likely the one program that can get money to the market the quickest and would require the least tweaks in order to make it have the impact that was intended. So we've got kind of a shell of an existing SBA program, but this is not your ordinary SBA program in any regard. And we're going to go through that. So everybody's familiar with what occurred, I think, on Friday in terms of the $2.2 trillion CARES Act being passed. And in particular, in that act was a specific program that is the Paycheck Protection Program that allocates $350 billion to this particular program with the objective of helping small businesses keep workers employed. If you think about what this program really is about, it's a forward-thinking business interruption program. But unlike any business interruption program, which really would look at lost revenues, that's not what this does. What this does is it says, okay, what is it going to cost to keep you to keep your employees employed and keep you basically from a fixed cost perspective in a status quo, so we can make it through the duration of the next 2 months, the next 8 weeks or so, and come out of this thing on the other end. And that's what really the program they focus on designing it around. So let's kind of go through a couple of questions, Jerry, if I can, and then what I'll do is, if you've got any questions that were posed to this specific program, I'll answer them. But the first question that everybody obviously is wanting to know, hey, am I eligible? And what does that mean? Well, first of all, if you would otherwise be eligible under any existing SBA program, then you're going to be eligible here, component, and a fairly significant piece. That's important because what it indicates is that any of the restrictions related to revenue cap and or in instances where there's been where the SBA has previously defined small business concerns in a manner that is less than 500 would then be captured, it would appear, through this specific provision. And that makes a lot more folks eligible that otherwise may not have been eligible for a loan. Also, what is important to note is that any options and subrogacies, at this time, they're not included in this program. It would require, more likely than not, it would require an act of Congress to change that. And I know there's been some discussion regarding that, and I don't, you know, we'll see what happens with the guidance that comes out, but that's at least what it says. Now, the other important news that comes out of this in terms of eligibility is that sole proprietors and those who operate as independent contractors are also eligible under the program, which is a change from your normal SBA guidelines and how that would work. There is a pretty significant issue related to what's called affiliation that is important to discuss, particularly for those that are in the accommodation or food services sector, which is defined specifically by what they call an NAICS code of 72. And see, if you are an employer and you have less than 500 employees, then you're going to be eligible under the program. If you have over 500, there is a potential that you could be eligible based off of the Small Business Administration definition that where they allow for example, in certain manufacturing sectors, they allow for either 750 or 1,000 or 1,200 jobs to be considered small business. And here, what they've done is they said, if you're in the accommodation and food services sector, we're not going to count your global jobs. We're going to look at per site location, per physical location. And if you have 500 employees there, then we're going to, in essence, waive the affiliation rule and allow for that specific site to be accommodated in the program. And the reason for that, obviously, is how significant that market industry has been hit. So that's, in short, the eligibility component. When you calculate your employees, you're looking at all full-time, part-time, and what they call as and other status, such as if you like lease employees or have temporary employees through a temp program or something along those lines, will be counted in the eligibility. So now you're sitting there and you think, okay, I think I fit that category. What do you do next? We're all sitting here now waiting for these rules to be promulgated. There's about 1,800 lenders who I believe are eligible to participate from a lending standpoint. Unlike the economic injury disaster loan program, where you would go straight to the SBA and apply through it, here you're going to apply through one of those 1,800 lenders. We provided Jerry with a list, and Jerry, if we can circulate that, of all the current lenders in Louisiana who are certified by the SBA to participate. Certainly those are eligible, and there's others who are eligible too who don't ordinarily participate in SBA that can lend under the program too. So what are they going to be looking for? Under a traditional 7A loan, things like what they call the credit elsewhere test, where you have to establish that you can't get credit somewhere else, or they take a look and see what collateral or guarantee strength you might have. Those are not required under this program. Very flexible waivers and eliminations of those restrictions, which obviously are significant. What they're looking for, and this is, again, gives you an idea of how the intent of this program is developed, but what they're looking specifically for is for a certification that that moving forward as a result of the coronavirus itself, that you're going to have issues meeting your payroll and meeting your general obligations related to rent and mortgage payments, utilities, and the like. And that's really one of the critical factors that they're going to ask you to certify. And the way it's stated is the uncertainty of current economic conditions that make the loan request necessary to support ongoing operations. So that's really the key trigger. And if you can accomplish that, then you're going to be able to obviously move forward with your lender. As the program gets stood up, what we're suggesting is folks reach out to their lender, make sure that you're on their intake form, intake list, and get into a position where you are ready to move forward with your application. And they'll obviously have intake components consistent with the regs that come out. All right, how much can you borrow? There is several definitions that are important, and I'll kind of go through these quickly, but you're going to be able to take your payroll cost and multiply that by 2.5 at 250% of your payroll cost, and that's going to be the amount that you're allowed to borrow, not to exceed $10 million. Again, there's some intricacies to those rules in terms of what is included in payroll costs. There is also a $100,000 limit relative to what can be included in that per employee. This is subject to interpretation, but what the general interpretation we've heard and are seeing so far from others and ourselves is that you will be able to include up to $100,000 as part of your calculation if somebody earns over $100,000, and then over that would be excluded from developing what your payroll cost would be for this criteria. And the big part of the question is, okay, well, we hear about this being a forgiven loan. What does that mean and how does that work? So we've established in general how you get to your maximum loan amount. And in order to be able to establish what that amount can be forgiven, you're going to look at specifically the uses over an 8-week period that you can use them for. Those include the same definition, payroll cost, as well as interest on mortgage obligations, rent on leasing agreements, and payments on utilities. For those who have employees who are tipped or earn additional wages through some similar mechanism, then those would also be forgiven if included in their payroll. in your use of the funds. So that's how you define the forgiveness component. And the way that will work, as we appreciate it, again, subject to the rules that come out, but after your 8-week period, there's going to be a mechanism to establish how you use the funds consistent with this program. And your lender is going to receive that information, submit it to the SBA, who will then turn around and pay the lender that amount of money, of which would then forgive and cancel that portion of the debt. Well, what happens if you use the money for purposes that are not within the forgiven definition? That amount, up to 4% interest, will turn into a loan of a term not to exceed 10 years, and you would pay it accordingly with some deferment options that would be available for you to take into consideration too for a period, I believe, up to a year. Jerry, in general, again, there's a lot of different scenarios and details that go into evaluating this per company and per instance. And a big part of it is evaluating if this program fits you. Some folks may have small payroll, for example, a low payroll number, and their need for liquidity is much higher for a number of reasons, and perhaps a different SBA program, either through the CARES Act or otherwise, might be more appropriate. However, this program certainly is the one that most people are interested in large part due to the forgiveness of it. But the other component that folks we understand are looking at is the impact then of what the Families First Act means and how it comes into play for making decisions about what to do literally this week with their employees or in the next coming days with their employees and moving forward. So with that, I'm happy, Jerry, to ask any questions, or we can move on to the next speaker.
Chris, thank you for that. I'm going to ask two quick questions that are recurring in the questions we're receiving, and then we're going to continue on and ask more questions after. Can you please touch on a company's ability to qualify for both the EIDL, the economic injury disaster loan, and the 7A concurrently?
Yeah,
The other question was about if you have laid off an employee or furloughed an employee and you acquire the 7A loan, do you have to rehire the same employee, or is it more tied to the position?
Okay, so both questions I'll answer in terms of the interpretation that we have, which is going to obviously be subject to change with the regulations that are going to be coming out. And again, we're hearing that these regulations may come out the middle to latter part of this week. That's the goal. That seems to be an aggressive goal, but you know, there's a lot of folks working really hard to make that happen. So we hope it certainly does. First question, the economic injury disaster loan program and the PPP interplay. You cannot take both loans and use them for the same purpose. If you have a pre-existing loan, then that's going to obviously be for something completely different and is a different animal. But what most people are concerned about is, or asking is, can you either take advantage of both programs, or what happens if you've already began the process or have taken a loan in the economic injury program? If you already have money from the economic injury loan program, you're going to disclose that in your loan application under the PPP, and it'll be addressed through that process and be treated, in essence, in a manner that will not allow you to double dip. What you can't do is exactly that. You can't double dip. So you're not going to be able to do to leverage both programs under, as we appreciate, the duplicity rule that they've put into place, at least through the law, and I expect that's going to be consistent with the regulations. Now, on the second question, the question is whether or not you've got to hire the exact same people back. Again, the law itself does not go into the level of detail explaining exactly how that that calculation or evaluation is going to work. Our view of it, and if you take it in light of really the whole act itself, practically speaking, I don't think that there's a mechanism really to do that. Meaning, I don't think there's going to be an instance where you're going to submit a roster of people who you've employed and compare it and make sure it was 90% of those people come back. Obviously, there, you know, in this time, there's going to be folks who look to go take other opportunities with other jobs, for example. There may be a reason why one sales group is not as active as another, or one, you know, one group of folks, you know, team at your company may have a different impact as a result of this. What probably is going to come out, again, we need to see the regs, but speculating here only, is that there's probably going to be some kind of mechanism where you're counting by heads and by payroll cost numbers, which are the two critical numbers that they've already defined and have some basis for definition in the act. But we'll have to see, Jerry, and see how the rules come out on.
One last question for right now pertains to credit worthiness, and do companies have to show their credit worthiness, or how is this? How are these loans going to be distributed?
So the way, so it's going to be through lenders, not the SBA. And what the lenders are not going to be asked to look for is what's called the credit elsewhere test, meaning that you could gain this credit through a traditional lending source or otherwise. They're also not going to ask for a personal guarantee or for collateral. So in essence, the ability to repay, this is 100% backed by the federal government in terms of a guarantee. The ability to repay is in essence, non-factor. It's what are you going to do with the money, and what are you going to certify your uncertain current economic condition to be as the critical issues that they're going to look at as compliance with the program. Now, Jerry, I'll tell you, I don't think anybody's ever seen a program like this. And so asking for basically a verification that you need the money in order to pay payroll, and that being a certification that the uncertainty means you cannot guarantee you'll be able to do that without this help, is a very obviously unique situation. And I anticipate the rules that will come out will provide some specific documentation and information that will be new perhaps to the 7A loan program for this exclusive purpose. And we'll probably see some of the traditional forms and documents that you would see in a 7A loan application be disregarded as not necessary.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And we are going to continue, and then we'll come back for some questions. Just one of the recurring questions we continue to get is where can they find this application, and how do they start this process now? I just want to underscore what Chris said at the outset is the 7A loan program is an existing program that many of the banks are familiar with. However, those banks are still waiting on the regulations and the documentation that are going to be necessary for this round of funding. So we'd ask you to be patient with those banks, and you can certainly continue to monitor our website, and we'll put that information out as soon as it is available. Next, we're going to cover some of the labor ramifications and items that were covered in the CARES Act. And to do so, we have on the line Greg Ruschel, who is the labor and employment team leader at Adams and Reese. Greg?
Thanks, Jerry. You know, I think a lot of folks out there are sitting there wondering, does it make sense for me to apply for this SBA loan that's going to be forgiven over time, or am I better off not doing that? And my answer to you who are sitting there wondering what you should do is, you should be conducting an individualized assessment of your particular business. Perhaps it makes sense for some of you on the line to apply for the loan and get the payroll protection program underway. so that you can continue to pay your employees. The intent is to continue to pay your employees through June of this year. Now, for some of you, maybe there's enough uncertainty or your financial situation is such that the SBA loan doesn't make sense for you. Perhaps it's more appropriate for you to do layoffs or temporarily furlough employees. And if you were to decide to do that, instead of you paying your employees through the SBA loans, what your employees are going to have made available to them by virtue of the CARES Act is additional unemployment compensation benefits. They're going to add a $600 a week benefit over and above what employees would have otherwise been paid in unemployment under normal circumstances. One of the questions we've been getting a lot is if all of my employees go and seek unemployment benefits, is that going to hurt me down the road like a traditional unemployment claim would? In other words, am I going to get dinged and have to contribute more into the state unemployment compensation fund? Again, the regs are not out yet, but our understanding is that the answer to that question is no. The federal government is providing all of these additional benefits, and they are not going to require the traditional funding sources, which includes employers, contributing to the fund. So it should not have any impact if that's the route you decide to take in terms of tax liability or having to potentially increase your obligation to fund the state's unemployment compensation fund. The other thing that I think everybody needs to be mindful of is that this is separate and apart. Whether you decide to take advantage of the SBA loans or not, this is completely separate and apart from the mandated paid sick leave obligations that many of you will have under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. You cannot use money you receive from these SBA loans to pay the mandated sick leave that is required under the Families First Act. You are still required to utilize the tax credits in order to reimburse yourself for any cost associated with mandated sick leave. But what the Senate did that the House didn't originally do is they tweaked the tax credit a little bit. They made it immediate. In other words, they provided for an immediate advance of the tax credit. And they also waived any penalties you would otherwise have been assessed by the IRS if you failed to make your quarterly payroll deposits with the Treasury Department. And so the practical effect of what Congress did with this new CARES Act is they said, if you got to pay sick leave, do not pay us your payroll taxes. We want you to use that money instead to fund the sick leave requests that you're going to get from your employees. Don't pay us, pay your employees. And the other thing in that regard that I want to highlight for folks is that a lot of people thought that these stay-at-home orders that are being issued by all these governors throughout the country were going to trigger an obligation to pay the mandated sick leave. But the Department of Labor came out with guidance over the weekend, and a general stay-at-home order, based on my reading of the new guidance, is not going to trigger your obligation to pay up to that 80 hours of mandated paid sick leave. A lot of businesses were panicking, thinking that as soon as this law goes into effect on April 1st, by virtue of Governor Edwards' stay-at-home order, that you are automatically going to be legally obligated to pay all of your employees up to 80 hours of paid sick leave. According to the guidance, that is not the case. According to the guidance, the only sort of government order that is going to trigger an obligation for you to pay is if it's specific to individuals and they are not allowed to leave home or wherever they may be under any circumstances whatsoever. For example, Governor Edwards' order still allows us all to go get groceries. We can also still go and go to the bank if we need to. But the type of order that they are contemplating by the paid sick leave law is something entirely different. It's an order where you got to stay where you are for 14 days and you can't leave under any circumstances whatsoever. You got to stay put wherever you are. And you can't work remotely. Under that scenario, you would have an obligation to pay the mandated paid sick leave under that first triggering event related to government orders. So I wanted to go ahead and point that out as well. Other than that, that's really it from an employment standpoint with regards to the interplay between the Paid Sick Leave Act and the SBA loans. Just know that you can't double dip. You're not going to be able to use the SBA loan to pay the mandated sick leave. You've got to use the tax credits.
Thank you, Greg. And just a quick question on the labor front. If you have furloughed employees, they are eligible for unemployment benefits, correct?
Congress relaxed the eligibility requirements for seeking unemployment, and the answer to that is, I believe, yes. They should be encouraged to apply. I mean, I can't make any guarantees as to whether or not somebody's going to qualify for benefits, but if someone is furloughed and not being paid right now, I would absolutely encourage them to seek unemployment benefits because the rules have been relaxed. One other point I want to make, Jerry, before we move on, is that a lot of people have said, wait a second, I did a lot of furloughing and layoffs 3 weeks ago because I was panicking. Can I apply for the forgivable SBA loans? And the answer is yes. Congress included a provision in this new bill that is not going to penalize employers who laid off or furloughed workers between prior to the effective date of the act. It's retroactive to February 15th. If you hire people back, the feds are gonna still allow you to participate at the maximum loan amount, and they're gonna allow you to forgive the loan if you pay those people through June. So there's a couple of different options for folks, even if you've already furloughed or laid off. Don't think it's only, your only option is to send your employees, or I should say your ex-employees, to state unemployment, because they could, in theory, be rehired, and you could take advantage of these SBA loans.
Thank you, Greg. Another provision in the as an incentive for businesses to help recover has been changing some of the tax recording deadlines. And to address that, we have Johnny Damiano with Adams and Reese.
Thank you, Jerry. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Great. We just thought it was important to briefly mention that another mechanism the government has enacted to free up cash flow for businesses and entities is to move some of the tax deadlines, which many of you may have already heard, but tax filings and payments that would normally be due on April 15th have largely been extended to July 15th with a few exceptions. So in essence, anybody with a federal tax return or a payment that is due on April 15th is eligible for this relief. That would include if you're going to be making your 2019 tax payments in April. It would also include if you typically or your business typically makes your 2020 first quarter estimated tax payments. Those will all be automatically extended to July 15th, including any payments you would make as for taxes on self-employment income. You don't have to actually have been affected in any way by COVID-19 in order to qualify for this extension. It's automatic. A couple of things just to note, it does not apply to things like estate taxes, gift taxes, or things that wouldn't ordinarily fall into the income tax realm, or that wouldn't ordinarily be due on April 15th. You don't need to file anything additional. It's done automatically. And if you can't file by July 15th, or you think you're gonna need more time to make your payments, then you do need to file and ask for an extension. But interest and penalties on anything that are owed will not start to run until after July 15th. And some people have already filed their taxes for last year. And if you have and you owe money, you don't have to make that payment until after July 15th. One last caveat that kind of interesting, and maybe they're gonna address it later, but if you pay quarterly taxes, you will owe that first quarterly payment on July 15th, it's been moved, but your second quarterly payment at the present time would still be due on June 15th. So your second quarterly tax payment would be due as it was initially scheduled and before the first payment would be due. Maybe that's something they're going to take up later or was an oversight, but as of now, that's the way the law reads. And lastly, if you make IRA or other retirement contributions that you need to make at the time you file those April 15 taxes, that deadline is also extended. So we just wanted to make sure everybody was aware of those deadlines being moved in an effort to help business free up additional cash flow.
Thank you. Thank you, Johnny. Now batting cleanup is Jeff Brooks in the DC office of Adams and Reese. Jeff, you want to share some overview with us?
Yeah, good afternoon, everyone. Things have been fast and furious up here, as I'm sure you're aware, as the documentation and the law and everything gets done and has been passed. Obviously, the big thing, as several of my partners mentioned, is the guidance that's going to be coming out for any of the issues that were mentioned today, from the Paycheck Protection Act, the retention issue, the retention tax credit issue, and so forth. Obviously, there is some specificity within the bill for certain things, 10 days for the Paycheck Protection Act, 15 days for other things. It's our understanding, after doing some digging today, that they're hoping, SBA and Treasury is hoping, for the end of this week to issue those guidances. They believe everybody's ready to go and they want to get those dollars out of the door. I think the big thing that I wanted to add is obviously one of the questions that gets asked all the time now is, what's next? I think while Congress has gone till April 20th, because of any number of reasons, a lot of which is social distancing, I think they are, members are working right now on a stimulus 4 and potentially a stimulus 5. That stimulus 4 could encompass some fixes that need to take place as things get moving, whether it's in the Paycheck Protection Program or the checks that need to go out for the stimulus or tax issues that need to be tweaked, because this was written in such haste that they maybe figure something out. So some technical corrections that need to occur. There's also talk of additional dollars coming down for state stabilization funds, maybe even for education funds. Obviously, with no sales tax in many around the country, municipalities, local government, states are falling behind in their budgets. There's already some dollars down there, but many states and local governments are demanding and requesting that more dollars flow through there. And then finally, I think they're going to be looking for a infrastructure package. Everywhere you turn up here, that's what you hear. They're going to be looking to do some form of an infrastructure. They've been talking about that for years, and they haven't had a way to pay for it because they need to pay for. This may be an opportunity to somewhat ignore that pay for and do what they did with the rest of the $2.2 trillion that just came down, is make it emergency spending, at least for the next 5 years. So I think that's what we have to look forward to, plus things that pop up between now and then. As orders are issued, as more dollars are needed for the federal government to keep up with the cases, especially in Louisiana. So, Jerry, I think that's all I have, and we'll open it up to questions.
Jeff, while we're on you, just very quickly, are you hearing anything in D.C. about companies that still have Katrina disaster loans in place? Any discussion about those potentially being forgiven now?
That I have not heard that, but it would not surprise me in the least if our delegation is probably one step ahead of us already and contemplating that. I have not heard of that because there's other disaster loans that are in parts of the country as well, from other, whether it's a tornado or hurricanes on the East Coast or Florida. That has not been mentioned specifically, but I'm sure our Mr. Scalise and both senators are probably well ahead of that and trying to see if there's an opportunity for that.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. Now I'm going to open it up to questions. Most questions are all pertaining to the loan programs. So Chris, I'll start directing it to you, but if others want to chime in, please do so. We're getting a number of questions regarding self-employed, independent contractors, 1099 folks. How are they eligible for this, for the PPP?
So what the legislation did was it opened up as an eligible category, individuals who operate as a sole proprietor or as an independent contractor. And what that means is that they can borrow money that is basically how they pay themselves. And again, I know we may sound like a broken record in saying this, we need to see exactly how the regulations define, interpret the law in order to get there. But the compensation or income of a sole proprietor or an independent contractor will allow them basically to take their wages, their commissions, their income, their net earnings, similar compensation, and whatever that amount is, use that as your basis for your payroll costs. Of course, we still have the issue with the $100,000 limitation in terms of the that payroll. And how that calculates. But, you know, if you look at it from that standpoint, if you get to the cap out and you're a sole proprietor and you got 250% of what you can get in terms of payroll cost, then you could get $250,000 in a forgiven loan if you use it for allowable sources. If you review the act itself, it appears that it is intended to apply the $100,000 limit to these particular eligible categories as well. But again, we'll have to see how the rules play it out. That's how it appears to work in terms of the language, the letter of the act itself.
And then can you talk a little bit about the size standards for the company, whether it's employee or revenue standards?
Yeah, so this program basically opened 7A up. So if you were eligible under the SBA for 7A previously, you still are. There are companies that, depending on what category you were in, for example, perhaps you were in a retail, you sell stone, for example. I believe there's like a $17 million revenue cap in that category. It doesn't look at how many employees you have, but a revenue cap. By virtue of the OR provision that says any business concerns that employ less than 500 takes that financial component away and does not require you to look at the NACIS to determine what that revenue cap might be. The other thing it does is that there are also limitations under 500 employees in those categories as well. But more importantly, there are categories that are above it. So you're going to be able to take advantage if you're in an industry where you're north of 500 employees and not be injured or made ineligible if you are in a category that otherwise would have been deemed to be a small business under 500 employees based on your NACIS code.
The 2.5 times the payroll rule, that's 2.5 times the payroll for the month?
Yeah, so what you do is you take, good question, and I'll make sure I clarify this. What you do is you take a calculation of your prior 12-month payroll. For seasonal employees, there's a slightly different mechanism that you'll be given an option to take a more favorable calculation. But you take that and you come up with your monthly average payroll costs as defined, which means based on how calculated under the law, and that's what you're multiplying it by. So that's correct.
Okay, and I'm just going to keep firing away right now. There are some questions regarding confusion over the 7A loan and the PPP loan. Can you please clarify that that's one and the same?
Yes, it is. This program is using the 7A loan program with with certain criteria and or requirements being eliminated from a normal 7A program, but it is through the 7A loan program. That is correct.
And the bill allows for certain employee tax credits. It's another provision of the loan. Can a company qualify for those tax credits and the SBA forgiveness under the PPP?
So I think there's two different questions being asked in there, and let me see if I can clarify, and then Greg and I can probably answer the question. There is another program in the CARES Act that is called the Employee Retention Tax Credit Program. What that basically does is, if you don't fall in one of these categories, whether it be the PPP or potentially the corporate liquidity fund, which is for mid-sized companies, there is a program where you can take a tax credit if you retain a certain level of your employees. You can get 50% tax credit based off of your payroll cost, which would happen again next tax season when you go to file. That is one program. The other tax credit program is related to paid leave, and there is interplay between how you receive that tax credit and what you can and can't use certain portions of the loan for. And Greg, you mind responding to that question?
Yeah, just to make clear and to clarify, any requirement that you have to pay paid sick leave under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, that's the law that came into effect about a week to 10 days before this law that we're talking about here today, the CARES Act. That's separate and apart. That's not going to have any impact on your SBA loan eligibility, because you're going to get reimbursed for the mandated paid sick leave in the form of immediate tax credits and against what you would otherwise owe the Treasury for your quarterly payroll taxes. So they're completely different and separate. And if you were to get an SBA loan, though, again, there's no double dipping. You can't use the SBA loan to pay your mandated sick leave. It's not allowed. There's an express prohibition in the law. You got to use the tax credits.
The economic injury, the EIDL loans allow for loans to be made to nonprofits. Are nonprofits and or churches eligible for the PPP?
So sorry, the answer is if you are a 501c3 subject to any other regulatory restrictions outside of this act, the answer is yes. If you are not a 501c3, based on our interpretation of the act, the answer would be no.
Okay. The let's see, just going through questions right now. For the loan forgiveness to take place, is there a timeline on how quickly they need to rehire those employees if they've been either laid off or furloughed?
If you don't hire back everyone, let me put it this way. This is Greg. The sooner you hire folks back, the better it's going to be for you from a forgiveness standpoint. Because if your headcount isn't at what it was on February the 15th, it's going to sort of decrease incrementally what is eligible for forgiveness. So, you know, I'll use a common example. If you had 100 employees on February the 15th and you apply for the SBA loan and you only have 25 active employees, you're not going to get that entire SBA loan forgiven. But if you hire back and you're near that 100 employee headcount, the forgiveness component should, in theory, work to make you whole. But there's going to be some reductions and penalties that are going to be triggered if you don't hire folks back. The clear intent of Congress is hire everyone back and continue to pay them through June with this money that we're giving you. It's essentially a bridge loan to enable you to continue making your payroll.
In calculating the average payroll for the 2.5 times calculation, can employees hired through staffing or rented from staffing companies be eligible in that calculation?
The answer is yes. Leased employees are listed, and temporary employees are listed as part of that calculation under the Act.
Okay. Can anybody speak to the cost associated with medical insurance, hospitalization insurance, and other benefits, and how are those calculated in terms of this program? Are they eligible for forgiveness?
For medical expenses, the categories for forgiveness include payroll costs as defined in the Act, interest on any mortgage obligations, rent on a leasing agreement, payments on utilities such as electricity, gas, water, transportation, phone, internet, and you can also include wages that would ordinarily be received if the employee were working, such as tips and additional relative compensation. Greg, you may want to discuss how that interplays with the Families First Act and the credit component.
Well, the only comment I have there is that there is a mechanism for you to use some of this forgivable SBA loan to pay the employer's share of health insurance premiums. That is a permissible expense, just like utilities and mortgage interest. You can use this money to help you pay the employer portion of health insurance premiums for your employees.
Okay, is there any test as to how long a entity has been in business in order to qualify for the payroll?
The covered period for this legislation is February 15th, 2020, and it's retroactive, the law, through the end of June. So if you were a going concern, meaning you were in business or you were ramping up to be in business around that time, at least by February 15, 2020, then yes, you're going to qualify for these loans and this assistance. What Congress does not want folks to do is to go run out and start some LLC now and try to take advantage of this program. It is designed to help businesses that were essentially in business as of February 15th, 2020 or after.
Okay, and what if a company has already applied for an EIDL, an economic injury loan, but now wants to apply for the PPP, provided they're not double dipping, is that allowed?
Yeah, so the short answer is yes. For those folks who have already applied, but who have not received their grants, and they've got either their identification number or going through the process and have not yet received it, there is provision that provides a deadline of March 31st related to the economic injury disaster loan funds. If you receive them before then you can wrap them in to the, if you close on that loan before then, you could wrap them into the PPP loan. But if you have a pending application or if you haven't filed yet, very candidly, I think it's best to wait and for these regulations to come out and to go through the PPP program, assuming that you do your estimated payroll calculation and determine that this is in fact a better route for you to go, as Greg was mentioning earlier, taking into consideration all those factors. If you went this route, this would be of benefit because you are going to create less complexity and or go through another whole process that you don't need to go through to get to the same endpoint.
And Chris, maybe you can touch on, in addition to payroll, What are the other items that can be used in order for the 7A loan to be forgiven? What other types of uses for those proceeds?
You can if you use the proceeds for interest on mortgage obligations that are incurred in your ordinary course of business, if it is rent related to a leasing agreement, any payments on utilities such as electricity, gas, water, transportation, telephone, or internet, and ancillary wages such as tips and additional wages that you may see depending on a specific trade, that could be calculated, included, it would be covered as part of the forgivable component.
Greg, this one might be for you. The payroll tax credit, is that credit against the entire payroll liability or just the employer's portion of Social Security and Medicare?
It's just the employer portion. So whatever you as an employer would have had to pay to the Treasury on a quarterly basis, they're going to make those funds immediately available to you to use for another purpose. And that purpose is to provide the paid sick leave if there's one of those six triggering events under the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act, or a parent is forced to care for a child under the expanded FMLA for up to 12 weeks due to a school closure.
Okay. And again, I may be repeating myself with this question, but independent contractors offering a professional service, are they part of their own monthly payroll in order to apply for a loan?
Jerry, you know, it's a little more fact intensive than that and would require to go through exactly how that individual treats his company. The way that the act is intended to apply to sole proprietors, independent contractors is to determine what their net earnings of self-employment are and or that they're similar compensation. So how they structure their pay, that their own pay is going to be dependent, number one, on the rules as the SBA comes out with, obviously. But the letter of the act suggests that you're going to look at those net earnings and use that number as your payroll number to be able to come up with that monthly number.
Thank you, Chris. And with that, I want to thank all of our panelists. We still have questions rolling in, so we're going to attempt to answer as many of those as possible online. We'll continue to update our resource guides at www.jedco.org. Perhaps the most often asked question throughout the this conference call has been, where can we find the list of lenders? And we will have that list posted up on our website this afternoon. And again, those lenders are still waiting guidance at this time too. I want to thank the parish council, the parish president's office for all of the efforts throughout the parish in the wake of this situation. I also want to extend a great deal of gratitude to Adams and Reese for jumping on this call and providing their expertise. Thank you all so much, and stay tuned to jedco.org for updated information throughout the pendency of this emergency. Thank you all.